Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm honored to have as my guest today Edward P. Jones, and we'll be discussing All Aunt Hager's Children, published by Amistad Press, a division of HarperCollins. And first of all, Mr. Jones, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
In the new collection, All Aunt Hager's Children, there are 14 stories, five of which have been in the New Yorker, and the title story, All Aunt Hager's Children, is one of them. And I'm wondering, as I was reading some of the stories, did any of these stories threaten to take off and become novels as you were writing them?
No, I think when I, the vision I had in my head of all the stories, they were always stories. I did want to try, though, to have stories that when the reader finishes, he or she has a sense of having read a novel.
Mm-hmm.
That's why some of them are quite long, and some of them have a number of characters, but they still fit within the range of the story. I mean, they're not, 40 or 50 pages or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I never envisioned them as novels.
Okay. In your first collection of stories, Lost in the City, which was published in 1992, I would like to mention to the listeners that there is a new edition out of that first book of stories, which does include A Rich Man, which was published in the New Yorker in 2003. So for those that haven't read the first collection, there's a nice new trade paperback, which does also contain the short story A Rich Man in it.
Right. And that's also an All Aunt Hager's Children.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. And your relationship with the New Yorker has been, it's really extraordinary in the new collection that five of them have been in the New Yorker. And in the acknowledgments, you mentioned David Remnick. And how did your relationship with the New Yorker develop? And it's, like I say, it's really extraordinary, and congratulations on having five stories accepted at the New Yorker in what is historically a fairly short period of time.
Yeah, well, I guess I never really thought about it. In 2003, when The Known World came out, I was also finishing of some of the stories that are now in this new collection. And I know that when I did Lost in the City, there wasn't anyone interested in the stories, even though most of them had never been published. And the only story, I think there were two that had been published maybe years and years before Lost in the City came out. And then the only people interested was Parish of Youth, and they published a story called Marie. No one else was interested. So I thought the same thing would happen with All Aunt Hager's Children. What I did was, as I finished the story, I would just send it to my agent so that we could be on record as completing the book. Because of the agreement I had with HarperCollins and Amistad.
Mm-hmm.
So I was rather surprised when he called me back, when he called me and said that New York was interested, because I, never once envisioned that to happen. They were, and the first story was published in the very same month that The Known World came out.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But, each time he calls me and says that, they're interested in one, I'm always surprised, as I was that very first time.
Mm-hmm. And talking for a moment about Lost in the City, some of the themes in your stories emerge there, and I love the story, The Girl Who Raised Pigeons, and one of the characters is Etta O'Donnell, who's 92 years old. And a lot of the stories in Lost in the City and All Aunt Hager's Children involve the strength of in the community of the older women in the neighborhood who keep the younger children in line, don't they?
Yeah. That was certainly the case when I was growing up, and I think the what happened is that, well, almost all the adults that I knew as a child was born and raised in the South, and you had a different way of looking at the world, where the people there felt that they had to look out for each other, or else God knows what would happen. So they brought that kind of thinking to the North, and certainly to Washington. And so you had in the 40s and 50s kids who were essentially the children of the neighborhood rather than just one particular family. Unfortunately, times have changed, drastically, so that doesn't happen very often.
And also in Lost in the City, one of the things that I was particularly moved, I remember when I first read the collection, was the first day. You write the story from the first person narrative view of a young girl, and it's about a young girl whose mother has to finally say, "I can't read. I don't know how to read or write, and I'm asking you to help me." And
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's a very difficult thing for people to understand, isn't it, and to deal with even today in the country that we live in.
Yeah, I mean, it's the case of my mother, couldn't be right. But as far as the story, though, there have been other instances where she knows that her mother can't be right, but this is the first time where it's sort of connected with school and learning and all of that, and she in her mother's eyes and her mother's actions, how much getting an education means to her mother. So the mother isn't able to do that, but she wants that for her daughter and for her other two children. So yes, I mean, you know, I 15, 20 years ago, I was reading something about literacy and literacy in the country, and the person writing it stated the fact that, well, if you go into a supermarket and you see the rolls of Campbell's soup, which at that time didn't have any pictures on them,
mm-hmm.
If you want tomato soup, you're lost. You have to ask someone because you can't read it. Something just as minor as that, of not being able to get the kind of soup you want. And of course, you know, it goes on from there, and that, you know, your life is in many ways stunted because you can't read.
Mm-hmm.
All the mystery out there, all the signs and all the every piece of paper you get in the mail is a great mystery.
And in All Aunt Hager's Children, which is a stunning collection of stories, at the dedication, I was really moved where on the dedication you write to the multitudes who came up out of the South for something better, something different, and again to the memory of my mother, Jeanette S. M. Jones, who came as well and found far less than even the little she dared hope for. That might be one of the most beautiful dedications I've ever read.
Yeah, I mean, the first book I wrote, Lost in the City, that was dedicated exclusively to my mother. And then Known World was dedicated to my brother, and then to my mother again. And this time around, the book is dedicated to my sister and then to the multitude, and again to my mother. And I've said that, you know, I don't know how many books there are in me, but any book that I write will be dedicated my mother. So, because my sense of my life is that, you know, I mean, if she had given up on me, if she could have walked away, because having three kids and one of them was retarded was a very, very difficult thing to do alone. But she stuck in there despite all the challenges she had in life. And the result is that I'm alive and I'm writing books.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, I mean, there's no human being, you know, in my life who's more responsible for that than my mother.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small thing to put that on the page. So I just wish, you know, that she, because she never lived to see any of the books I wrote published.
Yes, and I read where when you received the MacArthur Foundation grant that I read where you commented that your mother never made more than $75 in a month.
Yeah, well, it may have been a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
But she started getting ill, and so she was able to work less and less. No, I mean, I don't think, you know, I have some of her patients, the W-2s, and I think that, you know, we're talking about maybe $7,000, $8,000, you know, in the late 60s. she was ending her working life. But no, you know, she never did.
Mm-hmm.
Very much. And I like to do a little comment here and there on the fact that a lot of black Americans nowadays are doing far, far better than the people who came before them. In Lost in the City, the title story, I note that a woman who is a kind of lobbyist makes more than all of her ancestors put together, all of them back to Eve.
Yes.
And that girl is, that woman appears as a girl in the story, Common Law. And I want to make the same statement again.
Mm-hmm. And in the title story of the collection, All Ann Hager's Children, for aspiring writers, I would say that if one is to read the first three sentences of the first paragraph of that story, that's a finely crafted paragraph in terms of pulling the reader into the story. And I'm wondering how many drafts and revisions you had to go through until you got those first few sentences about the protagonist, until you got that exactly the way you wanted it.
Yeah, I think if, for the most part, it's like it is, and then Press of the License in New Yorker suggested that first phrase about. She didn't give me the words, but the words are always mine.
Mm-hmm.
Something about the fact that he was about to leave Washington. So I had to, you know, come up with that sentence. I've always been one, most of the stories, to try to pull the reader in as soon as possible, because there are a lot of things in this world that call for the reader's attention. And that particular paragraph there, which is quite a long one, there was a problem of having so many people mentioned in that paragraph. Three old women, the narrator, his employer who's gone to Israel, and the woman that he's avoiding, and the white woman who died at moments after stepping off the streetcar. And that's, I knew that was a lot to put on the reader's shoulders, but I felt it was all important, you know, that I do that. And I tried to make it as smooth as I possibly could, because I knew it was a lot. And, you know, the first three sentences are those first three, and after that there are 10, 12 others that the reader has to get to.
Mm-hmm. That was kind of the story in particular. When I read that and I reread it, I thought to myself, I was just wondering that one so easily could have blown into a novel that... I imagine you almost had to keep the brakes on when you were writing that, because there is so much information. It's just an amazing story.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing I was saying, that I would like the reader, when he or she has finished the story, to think that that they had read a novel. And I tried for that. Even with all the people and the events in the story, I still knew that I wanted to have it within the confines of the story, pages and all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard, because essentially there are three different events going on in the story. But you know, struggled and struggled, and it came about. I remember there was a couple of things there that, because a lot of the stories, most of all the stories that I write, I work them out in my head, and then I sit down and start writing. And there were a few things that I had always thought would be in that story, and when I got to writing it, I just could not find a place for it.
Mm-hmm.
It just made it off balance somehow, and I had to take those things out.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been one to, when it called for taking things out, I've always sort of been brave about doing that, because ultimately I think the story lives because of more power. Edit yourself that way.
Mm-hmm. And there was a line in All Ann Hager's Children, the story, where the protagonist's mother says, "You see what war does? It makes a man lose all natural fear of his mother."
Yeah, she's a pistol.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. I mean, she's a pistol. I mean, you know, the whole thing is sort of where they are an antagonist almost, you know, for most of the story. I mean, she doesn't feel like he's living his life the way it should be lived. And at the end of it all, you sort of get a sense from her that, as she tells him, you know, all the things that I did, you know, that you thought were bad, I did for your own good. Because I think she knows how bad the world is, given how she herself came to live in Washington. She knows how awful the world is. And just because he's living in the city and not the South, it's still bad for him.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't realize that yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he has a sense of what the world is like at the end, because all of these things have happened.
Yeah.
Including his finding the murderer and realizing what this the woman, or the white woman on the streetcar, was saying to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the mother is quite something.
Yeah, she is. I loved her.
Yeah.
And then the sixth... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think sometimes I have this thing. When I was growing up, there was a little girl, friends of ours, and she was very skinny, and she had this way of talking that was just awful. She stuttered. And Big Dan was quite gentle, and people picked on her. She went out of my life after I grew up, so I haven't seen her since the 60s. But when I wrote that story, The Girl Who Raised Pigeons, I thought of it then, and I wanted to give the name of that girl in that story her name. I couldn't do anything for Betsy Ann, the girl or the woman, but I could create this story where this little girl has plenty of spunk, and she doesn't take anything from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing that I could do. And I think in other cases, too, you know, because my mother was also a very gentle person, and I God knows what sort of indignity she suffered when she went out in the working world. And so I think in some cases I tried to create women who wouldn't take any guff from anybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing I can do about what happened to my mother except write the book and dedicate them to her, and then write women, the kind of women that I wish she could have been.
Yes, and I think what you're talking about is there's the sixth story in the collection is called A Poor Guatemalan Dreams of a Downtown in Peru. And I, number one, I love that title. But there's kind of what you're talking about, the generational passing of the torch of gifted young girls is there's the headmistress and Arlene, and there's a line where she says she may be coming old before her time. And I think that happens to a lot of children today. And but I love that title, and I love that that the generational saga you create in that story.
Yeah, I was. When you think of a nice title that you like, sort of are glad. You almost sometimes you think you're halfway there. I was very concerned in that story that so much does happen to Arlene, miracle after miracle, as I say, in which she is. Center of things that happen and people around her die. My editor said something about the mystical aspect of it, and I don't even think I thought of that. I just thought that I wanted to have this woman go through all of these things, and then when she's 54, 55, to find out that there are other women out there in the world who are going through the same thing. But yeah, that thing where, because she starts off, she's very poor, and I mean, she's just quite uneducated, and I mentioned that, you know, she couldn't even add two and two without, you know, using her fingers. And she goes on from there to get to PhD.
Mm-hmm.
From the NIH. So yeah, her story's a long one, too.
And it's the, Miss Waterford asks, you know, she says, am I always to be tethered?
Yeah.
And I thought of the beautiful Ernest Gaines story, A Lesson Before Dying, about the teacher who kind of wanted so badly to leave, but at the same time wanted to stay and carry on what the women, his aunt, had wanted him to do. And
yeah, a lot of times, of course, they don't realize what the impact that they're going to have on people. And of course, Arlene goes on to be educated and to dedicate, I think, the first book to that teacher.
Mm-hmm.
When that teacher first met her, she could never ever envision that after all, that Arlene would go on to be a fine woman.
Mm-hmm. And in the collection, All Aunt Hagar's Children, published by Amistad HarperCollins, there are some laugh-out-loud funny scenes, and I hope the readers, when they read it, aren't afraid to laugh. In Root Worker, we're not going to talk about anything in particular, but Jesse goes to see Dr. Holloway asking for some advice, or they have a discussion where I was laughing so hard I had to put the book down.
Yeah. For some strange reason, I can't remember the funniest moments ever.
Well, they're talking about a man, kind of a man's sex drive, is I guess
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, okay. And that was one where I, you know, when the story was coming to me and I thought all those things in that story, I thought about that, what he's talking about, as well as that whole thing with the television, you know. And there are times when you may not, the story will come to you and it comes to you in pieces. And you can only hope that you can put all the pieces together and make a story. When I can remember 5-6 years ago thinking about the things of the story, and just it hadn't really formed itself whole in my head. And that was one of the last ones I finished early this year. And when it was all done, you know, there was something that sort of I wasn't quite certain about. And there is a woman early on in the story, Maddie, who appears. And when I finished it and sent it to Eric, my agent, he wondered why Maggie didn't figure it in the end of the story. And it was like, yes, that was it exactly. And so I went back, and she is part of the ending of the story, the way it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why I didn't think about that early on.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes other eyes need look at something.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then the story, Common Law, that, when I read that, I read in its, for the listeners, why don't you, if you would, just talk a little bit about Common Law, and because you capture the, some of the subtle devastation of domestic violence that again, we're talking about a generational thing here, but at the same time, it's as prevalent today as it was during the times in which you set it.
Yeah, it takes place in the 1950s, and sort of in the center of it is this woman and her relationship with this man, her boyfriend, and the relationship is a rather violent one, and the violence coming from him. And the story, though, is about the impact that the relationship, which sort of played out in the neighborhood for everybody to see and hear, and its impact on one little girl and from her on a lot of the other children in that neighborhood. And the little girl is liked by a little boy, and he becomes kind of the hero. But I can remember thinking about that little boy as well. And initially I was going to have something where he died, but I just couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But no, it's about the violence and how that has an impact on the people who have to witness that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when I read that story, it had kind of a cinematic quality to me. I could see that story being turned into some kind of a film, because it had a real visual power to it, as well as a narrative prose power.
Well, almost everything that I do, I think, you know, there are the five senses that you hope you can put in the story, but sometimes it doesn't work out that way. But everything that I write starts from the visual. You know, that's what I'm always aiming for, so that a reader it's as if the reader is sitting in a movie theater and can see the story being played out, or in the case of The Known World, the novel being played out. Sometimes you can put in the other senses, but nothing works for me, nothing is as important for me as the visual. So I try to grab the reader right off of that.
Mm-hmm. And I read with The Known World, which won the Pulitzer Prize in, was published in 2003 and won the Pulitzer Prize in 2004. I read where you thought about that story for, was it like something like 10 years? And I was amazed that at the amount of time it took you to write it. And if you would talk for a moment about that, about how crystallized it was in your mind when it came out, because it's a very complex narrative novel, but it works perfectly.
Yeah, after I finished Lost in the City in 91-92, I thought, well, you know, it's time to think about what you're going to do next. And I recalled that one simple line. It wasn't professor's lecture. It wasn't in any book. The line was simply that there's a black slave owners. Well, I had, you know, before even an idea of a novel came to me, I had read several novels, several history books about American slavery. But because I was venturing into something where I was writing maybe 300 or so pages, I figured that what I had already learned about American slavery wasn't enough. So I had these 40 books. And my plan, starting in 92, was to read all those books and then sit down, however long it took me after that, after I read the books, sit down and start writing the novel. Well, and it's something that I mentioned before is that perhaps the creative part of the brain knows a bit more than the logical part. The logical part being the part of my brain that told me I had to read all those books.
Mm-hmm.
So year after year after year, I just simply could not get myself up to reading those books. And in the meantime, though, over those 10 years, I was fashioning a novel in my head. I did only 12 pages of writing that. So those 12 pages were the only physical thing anyone could touch. Everything else about the novel was in my head, not in a great detailed way, but in a general way. So I had it all laid out
mm-hmm.
from the beginning all the way to the very end. And after about 10 years, I realized that I was never going to read those books. So I just sat down and started writing the book that was in my head.
Oh, that's fascinating. And when you were done, when you finished the last draft of The Known World, did it feel like the process had completed itself, that from the initial genesis of the idea to the last period that you wrote, did you feel like that process was completed?
Yeah, but there were a few things that little stories that I composed about certain characters that I couldn't find a place for. And again, you know, I looked at it and I was rather brutal myself when it came to the editing. I was quite pleased with it. And people have asked me, well, you know, didn't you know what you had? Didn't you know you had this, that, and the other? No, I had no idea about it.
Mm-hmm.
You go to college, you go to graduate school, you read, you know, just for your own edification. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, my idea of what's good and right may not be what the rest of the world thinks is good and right. So I sent it off to my agent and, you know, called me up. And I said, you know, tell me the bad news first. And the only thing he said was it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that's Eric. And, you know, maybe he's holding back.
Yeah.
So then the next step was with Don Davis, who became my editor. And after, you know, they had already all decided that they would publish it, I learned that, you know, in the whatever initial meeting when she's trying to get the rest of the publishers on board with it, she was crying that she was driving the book.
That's fascinating.
And, you know, I mean, you hope that it will have a reaction on you, but again, you don't know that, you know, you don't know that.
Right.
But you did a good job.
Right. You did the best you could do.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last story in all on Hager's children is called Tapestry.
Yeah.
And in it, you say one of the lines is that God, people said, did more mysterious things in Mississippi than he did anywhere else on Earth. And that's another line I love.
Yeah. That came right after I mentioned that there was this guy, a white farmer, who had perfect teeth. And he went to bed one night and woke up in the morning with all his teeth laying on the pillow in a bloodless pile, I say.
Mm-hmm.
So then I mentioned that thing about Mississippi. I mean, you wake up with, you go to bed with teeth and you wake up with no teeth. That's another strange.
Yeah. Well, Edward, I really appreciate you taking the time out of what I know is a very hectic schedule right now to talk with us about all on Hager's children, the known world, and lost.
Well, here is my apartment is just a wreck. I mean, there's books and mail all over the place, and there was a New York Times reporter who was coming on Saturday and was interested in seeing what my apartment looked like. So I've been sort of trying to get it together, but I'm losing the battle.
We might also mention that one of the stories from the collection is in the current issue of The New Yorker that I'm looking at right here in front of me. Got Bad Neighbors is in the August 7th and 14th edition of The New Yorker.
Right, yes.
So congratulations on the success you've had with The Known World, Lost in the City, and all on Hager's children, and thank you for writing such beautiful stories, and I hope to catch up with you again down the road whenever the next next book comes out.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.